There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call
the Paulson No Shorting Zone.
And welcome to The Disciplined Investor. This is Andrew Horowitz, your out of control, pissed off, agitated, and very annoyed host of The Disciplined Investor. Well, it is another amazing week at The Disciplined Investor world of craziness. And thank you, Mr. Paulson and Bernanke and Pelosi, and the list goes on and on. And we have just really, beyond being speechless, I'm pretty pissed off. I think we have just seen a direct blow to the core, the inner workings of a free market. It is absolutely unconscionable that they took short selling and made a mockery of it, made a mockery of our markets, absolutely took the rule book and just threw it away. Okay, there was drastic measures required drastic results. No problem there. But what I do have a problem is really just taking the baby and throwing it out with the bathwater, or whatever other phrase you want to use to describe the fact that 799 companies are now exempt from being able to short sell them. And we're not talking about, you know, the naked short selling only, where in a nutshell the shares aren't deliverable. We're talking about just every possible variation of short selling has now been closed down for these 799 financial and financially related stocks. And I'm going to put a list on the website. Go over to disciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll put a link where you can grab the entire SEC document. And I am just absolutely freaked out because, you know, short selling is, forget about whether we want to do a short sale or not. That's not the point here. What the point is that it is part and parcel. It is an important component of the smooth and the inner workings of the, you know, any kind of a market that is trading stocks. And when you exempt that, you throw everything out of kilter. You really took it and took the entire stock market process and you just turned it and put it out of its orbit. And when that happens, very strange and awful things are going to happen in the end, because one day they will turn back on the short selling. They know this shouldn't be allowed. But what? Let me ask you something. Why couldn't they just reinstate the uptick rule and ban naked short selling on a select group of stocks much shorter? Why? Is this going to stop the short sellers from going after bad companies? No. And you know what? Today compared to yesterday, there is no change to the economic environment that we live in. We still have banks that are really in trouble. We still have houses that aren't selling. We still have a host of big bad problems out there, and this is just helping the stock market. Somebody brought up something brilliant to me. They said, we spent how much? $500 billion? Now, keep that in the back of your head for a second. I'll come back to that. But we spent $500+ billion just last week on top of the few $100 billion we've already spent to try to save the markets, the financials, the banks, the credit card companies. And you're telling me we could spend that all so easily, but yet we can't do anything about the atrocious state of health insurance in our country? I mean, think about that for a second. Just think about the depth of that and the incredible amount of not playing fair, if you will. Could you also imagine just 1 week later, if somehow, miraculously, Lehman Brothers was able to withstand one more week of pain? They would have been bailed out. Now, I got to tell you, something smells to high hell, doesn't it? Now, I am not going to blame, maybe I will, but let me throw out a little theory to you here. You know, Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, used to work for Goldman Sachs. As a matter of fact, he was the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, and I'll tell you something. I don't think he's going to let his boys go down. It's kind of interesting that now we are in a situation that we have only two, right? We're left with Morgan and we're left with Goldman. And Goldman and Morgan, they had only about 3% of their shares sold short as of Wednesday. But yet, they were starting to complain. John Mack was just up in arms. He was nuts. He was saying that we have to ban these short sellers, and this is a terrible situation. And right before my very eyes, Goldman Sachs, midday on Wednesday, went from about $110 down to about $86 in a matter of minutes, and it looked like the world was about to end. What's really interesting, though, is that when we look at the situation, you think, wait a second, this can't be happening like they're playing out. This can't be a concerted effort by the individual short sellers out there. It has to be the institutions. And some of the things that they're doing, you know, they call them Bazooka Paulson, may not be, I think, in the best interest. I am sure it's not in the best interest of the markets, and it is not in the best interest of the taxpayers, because let me tell you, if you haven't figured it out, and I'm surely haven't figured this out, by the way, it is too soon to find out all the numbers, this is going to cost us a fortune. Recently, Evan Newmark from the Wall Street Journal, he writes in a blog or an article series called Mean Street. He has a really interesting take on things, and he talks about, you know, is this a conspiracy or not? But I don't know about that. What I think it is just really poor management, and what I think it really is not a conspiracy, but I think it's Paulson trying to save the country and save the stock market, and at the same time trying to save himself. He writes that as of September 16th, he was talking about this. Actually, this is as of the 19th, I think he wrote this. He'll say it'd be interesting to see what Cuomo's investigation turns up. Andrew Cuomo from New York is doing an investigation, you know, wondering whether or not it's going to be, you know, if really this problem is all about short selling. But let's face it, I mean, that can't be the case, right? I mean, there may be something to do with it, but short selling, again, has an important role here. But let me just go on and talk about what he has written. Let me just find a spot that I thought was interesting. He says, this is great. He says, we don't know whether they're going to find anything or not, and maybe if they do, perhaps the trading and the credit default swaps, or, you know, that was a problem, and the panics and all the things that were going on. But he said it is, of course, delicious irony that the broker-dealers may be the victims of abusive short trading and short selling. They founded the hedge fund revolution by arming the ex-traders that they trained to the teeth with capital leverage and trading technologies. But when the children of the revolution turned on their founders, founders ran to Washington for protection. Don't forget, these are the guys that were really, you know, all about breaking the backs of firms by really coming and doing all the short selling. And now they're running for cover because it looks like their little kitties are coming to, you know, coming home and terrorizing the parents. So I got to tell you that this is a real problem. The markets will go up for a while, but if in fact they don't come up with a plan, they don't come up with an RTC-like bailout, watch out below, because again, the fundamentals haven't changed. Either way, this is going to be a real crimp. You know, this is going to buy us some time here, but a real crimp on consumers, because the tax on this is going to be outrageous. So I think we need to be very aware of that and very, very alert from that. If for those of you who are, you know, clients of the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, and for those of you that aren't, I want you to listen up about this. This is kind of interesting. Last week, on Wednesday, we covered our position in MasterCard at about 194. We shorted originally about $238 per share. And you can see this at the Strategy Lab. We talk about this at MSN. And we also covered a couple of other positions. But what we did more importantly was we entered a pretty substantial position in the fertilizer and chemical companies, TNH and Mosaic, as well as Intrepid Potash. And those really have just, you know, just roared incredibly. But more importantly, I think that I had mentioned this, the preferred stocks that are out there were getting just obliterated, just totally obliterated. So we picked up a couple of Royal Bank of Scotland pieces, also Prudential piece, and we're up about 60 to 70% in 2 days. What happened there was fascinating. Shares that usually trade about $25 per share and had about a 7% dividend, had no interest. Different than they were being sold and battered down, there was just no interest, in my opinion. No interest means there's no floor. Shares were trading at $6, $7, $8 a share. It was unbelievable for about 3 or 4 days there. We picked that up and the ETF, which I believe is the symbol PGP. We'll put all that on the website. And we're up 30% on that. So all in all, last week, which ended up being a flat to negative down on the S&P 500, we actually made 5%, In September, here's a really cool thing. In September, because we were short, very short, we had 20% of the position of the portfolio in MasterCard short and made about $45 per share on that. But what's really interesting about this is that we were short and didn't lose any money through the whole downturn in September. And we actually, when the markets were down 10% from September 1st to about the 17th or 18th, something like that, give or take a point or two, because they were down a total of 15%, and then they came back a bit, of course. The Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy was up 6% for the month of September because of the discipline we use with the Quanta Fund Tecna, utilizing hedging options and protecting ourselves on the downside. Remember I talk about the skyscraper approach? We want to walk into a skyscraper like our portfolio and see 100 floors on the way up, but only about 2 or 3 floors on the way down. That's how we want the portfolio to react. We want to have unlimited upside, very little downside. So that was really kind of neat for the for those people. We do have some more room in there. I did mention that we were considering kind of slowing down and closing it down. But with this, with these returns, I'm so pleased. I really want to share it if I can, and the experience of having the blog. If you're serious, don't do this if you're not serious. There's a $50,000 minimum. Go over to the Disciplined Investor. Click on the virtual tour there. You'll see a blue banner at the show notes or on the site. And you can take the 14-minute tour, but only if you're serious and you want to, you know, potentially consider investing. It is talk to anybody that's done it. We'll put up maybe, hopefully in the future, we'll put up a couple of people talking about their experience. But with the blog and the combination of some of the very sophisticated trading that we're doing and showing you what we're doing and not having a black box, it's just really great. And I'm so pleased. The emails I've been getting because of the great returns we've had right now, and showing people exactly what to do in these kind of markets has been very rewarding, not only financially, but also, you know, from the aspect of really being able to help people. So I'm very pleased about that. We're going to get to a great show today, a little bit of a long show. We have Harry Dent coming on, and then we have a discussion about how to day trade with Fausto Puglisi, as I promised you. Do me one favor if you have the opportunity. If you haven't had the opportunity to pick up a book, The Disciplined Investor, go over to Amazon. It's like $13.50. You want to learn some of the tools and techniques of what we do, it's all in there. And please, this is important. It's very important to me. I missed it last year because I forgot to do it, actually. But if you go over to podcastawards.com and nominate us, it's really important. I'm asking you to do it because we only have 1 week left to do it. And then hopefully we can get in the nominations and then we can vote. But go over and nominate the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the podcast of the year. And I need you to do it. If you're thinking everybody else is going to do it, don't think that. I need you to do it for me, please. Go over to podcastawards.com or go over to our site. We'll show you exactly how to actually, you know, submit the nomination. It would mean a great deal to me. We're going to return to the Twilight Zone with Harry Dent in a moment. So, you know, this is going to be a long one. Maybe you'll listen to this in a couple of different parts, but I think it's going to be well worth it. And I think you're going to learn a lot of things today. And Harry Dent has a book coming out. The original title was called The Great Crash Ahead. Oh, boy. Let's hear what he has to say in a minute. We'll be back. Thanks for joining me today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll be right back.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
All right, I promised you a very special discussion today, and if you've been around for a while, listening to me for a while, you know that I have a big admiration for a gentleman who, as I call him, a demographic economist, Harry Dent, and he's with us to talk about what in the world is going on. And by the way, before I cue up Harry, I want to tell you something that, I've read his books back to, in the early days, and I was always amazed at his going out on a limb and looking at, you know, what's going to be happening way in the future. It's hard enough to predict what's happening tomorrow, much less next week. And he, you know, kind of looks at the things in the viewpoint of years, not even, and in decades for that matter. And what's, I think, interesting is for someone to stick their neck out that much is really quite remarkable. So, Harry Dent, hello again, and how are you?
Good, Andrew. Great to be back with you.
Thanks. Listen, so we have historic volatility going on. We have unprecedented amount of trouble in the financial markets. And much of this you predicted, but kind of I thought that now that we're in this, we're in the mud and in the thick of it, what is your take on what's going on?
Well, you know, our take is basically this subprime crisis, as well as the recent high oil and commodity prices, is kind of like phase one of this. We've been saying for a long time that it gets more serious when this massive baby boom generation finally gets past their growing spending trends, which we think is going to happen by 2010. So we're really kind of at a plateau of a long-term demographic cycle. And, of course, coming with that came the peak of their house buying and this whole house bubble and all this excess borrowing and stuff. And now this stuff is unwinding. And our greatest insight now going forward is that, yes, this has been difficult thus far. We're seeing banks going under, you know, more than the early 90s and more like the 1930s. Well, the worst is yet to come. We're probably going to come into a phase where the market more rallies with lower commodity prices and the anticipation we're going to come out of this early to mid next year and some solutions like this resolution trust sort of solution proposed today by Paulson. But then next year, as we start to recover, probably early to mid next year, we're going to see inflation come back strongly and we're going to see commodities and oil prices come back strongly. And that's going to be the final trigger from our point of view that hits just as baby boomers are peaking spending. And the funny thing is that there's two very important cycles long term. One is a 40-year demographic cycle. And most people aren't aware, and I don't know how economists miss this because it's kind of obvious in a sense. Every 40 years, our economy and our stock market's gone through major long term peaks, 1929, 1968, and now in this kind of 2007 to 2009 period. But also every 30 years, just as clock-like, we've gone through peaks in commodities, 1920, 1951, 1980, and now we're due for another one between 2009 and 10. So we think the oil peak has not been put in, that the recovery next year here and around the world will give the kind of final spike there. Oil will probably go over $200 a barrel, and that will be the last bubble in this long bubble boom. You got to look back. Tech stocks peaked in 2000, and then housing in 2005, and home builders, and then bank stocks in mid-2007, and emerging stocks, emerging market stocks, a lot of them in 2008. I mean, we just keep seeing bubble after bubble peak, and the last bubble is the commodity bubble, which will probably peak late 2009, early to mid-2010.
Well, let's talk about a bubble for a second, because I am absolutely fascinated about these bubbles. And it seems that almost it's a game, it seems, that either we're really stupid. I mean, all of us were really stupid and just kind of charging in and charging out. And it kind of like reminds me of that, you know, you go to those parties and everybody in, everybody out, yeah. You know, kind of thing. Or, I mean, what is the whole, is it a behavioral finance thing or is it something greater?
Well, there's two sides to it, a good and a bad. One is human nature, and what most people do, there aren't that many geniuses in the world or people who really create new technologies and things like Henry Ford and Steve Jobs. Most people simply duplicate and copy and imitate what other successful people like them or people like them are doing. And so when we get towards the end of a trend, the end of a boom, and real estate's been going up forever and stocks have been going up forever, everybody piles in, and then all these Harvard MBAs leverage everything and hedge funds and stuff, and it just goes nuts because people start to think, well, gosh, this can't go down. And that was the thing we were warning in real estate very heavily in 2003 and 4 that we were coming in a bubble peak because the baby boom was going to peak there earlier than other spending, and people just weren't into that. No, real estate doesn't go down. If it goes down, doesn't go down for long, and it always comes back. And I'm like, no, you haven't looked at the 1930s in the U.S. You haven't looked at the 1990s in Japan where real estate was down 60-70%. So that's the bad side. Yeah, we as human beings all go off the cliff together, and every mutual fund manager held every, you know, tech stock overvalued, and every bank was making these dumbass loans here, you know, no money down and teaser rates and all this sort of stuff at the end of the thing. Because you have to do it to compete and to copy everybody. Now, here's the flip side, and here's the good side. The economy, in essence, kind of takes advantage of our greed. The economy loves, in periods like this, and we have to, when you talk about bubbles, you have to go back to the early 1900s, particularly between 1914 and 1929, the last real bubble boom and real technology explosion. moving mainstream. The economy loves to see these bubbles, loves to see all this money created, all this expanded investment. They want entrepreneurs and investors to try everything with these new technologies and find out what really works. And the way you find out what really works is you pull the rug out when the bubbles burst. And so from the late 20s to early 30s, you saw this bubble boom burst. And another thing that people can't understand today, we say, look, this is going to be a deflationary downturn. And people say, no, you got it wrong. It's inflation. We got inflation pressures now at the end of this boom, and the government's going to inflate their way out of this. And I'm saying, no, yeah, that's true. They're going to try. But when these bubbles burst, these banks have loans against them and all these hedge funds and all this leverage, and that you have to deflate that. And that takes money out of the system rapidly. So it means that the prices of everything goes down. Chicken, oil, you know, corn, houses, stocks, commodities.
But Harry, how does it happen when – so many questions I have for you. But how does it happen when we have as we're doing just simple math and counting up the mouths that are in the world, the amount of cars that are in the world – the economies that want to grow, and I want to talk to you. I want to bring it back to emerging markets in a moment. If you can remind me if I forget.
Okay.
But how does that all happen? I mean, how do you actually have commodities when they are saying that? And maybe there's different commodities do different things, but oil is going to run out, and there's just so much corn you can have, and so many chickens you can keep in an area, and I mean, and there's so many mouths you have to feed. How do commodity prices come down?
Well, first of all, it's because the world economy slows, and commodity prices always go to such extremes that they end up shooting themselves in the foot, and that's what happened in 1980. We had a series of recessions, the first one in 1980 and a deeper one in 1982, late 81, 82, which slowed down the economy worldwide and brought oil prices down from $40 a few years later in 1986 back to 11. And the emerging countries are far more sensitive. I mean, India especially and China to a large degree, they're far more sensitive to energy prices and food prices than we are. Mm-hmm. It's maybe 10% of our economy if you throw it all together, commodities. But over there, it's 40, 50, 60, 70% of their economies and their spending. So eventually it causes a downturn in those economies as well. Now, the difference is, this is a long-term slowdown demographically for the United States and Europe and countries like Australia, New Zealand that are like us. For these emerging countries, they've got decades of growth ahead of them, with some exceptions like China and some of the East Asian countries, but they have decades of growth. So it'll be a setback, and then they'll come back, and you know, sooner or later down the road, we'll have another commodity boom, another 30-year cycle. It'll peak around 2038 to 40. With even higher prices and greater scarcities, as you know, billions of people in India and China are sucking up everything again and creating excess demand. You also see innovations. The higher prices get in commodities, the more there's innovations that come through and say, hey, we can do this better. So, you know, we're looking for that, and it won't be the innovations most people think. You know, maybe Boone's Pickens has it right about, you know, wind power is a good source. And
oh, well, you know what? I'm going to debunk
that. But
there's
a lot of other stuff. It could be making energy out of seaweed or something.
Yeah,
you know,
but I'm going to debunk that. I'm going to try to debunk that whole Boone Pickens. Nice guy, nice fellow. Okay, much smarter than me and far wealthier than I. Far wealthier probably than I'll ever be. But the point of the matter is that let's not get past the fact that, you know, he wants to create less dependence on international oil. That's his real issue at hand.
Yeah, that's right.
And why is that? Simply, I mean, he owns a tremendous amount of oil fields, and he's in the production base or in the oil business. He's an oil man, and that's good for him. So let's not kind of put that past the whole issue as well, that if we can, in fact, get off the foreign independence, it's good. But I want to ask you about emerging markets. Emerging markets, here's my theory on this. There's this whole, you know, discussion that you know, China, the superpower, China is making things cheaper. My concern is that you eventually, it just stands to reason, you're going to run out of emerging markets, right? I mean, eventually, there's only so many places you can have an emerging market. And as you have the emerging markets and as you have the people that are working in the factories making cheap products, basically it's slave labor pricing, you have a great opportunity from a manufacturer standpoint to make a lot of money and to have a lot of growth. And your earnings can be very good because you use those products. Now, what happens, though, is that after a while, and what's happening in China right now, is that many of the people there are saying, you know what, we want better wages. We want better working conditions. We want pension plans. We want to have breaks. We want to have vacations. We want to live in better circumstances. We want to have better cars. And what happens is now they require more money, which that in itself, the working conditions, higher money, creates less a higher cost factor for their products. Therefore, they're no longer as competitive, and that's why we're seeing a tremendous amount of jobs go to Korea, Vietnam, various places around the world, away from China. Factories are closing in China, and you know this. Therefore, kind of, let me spill this over. Their economy eventually slows, even though the intent was to grow it, and the commodity need and the commodity enhancement that we saw for some time actually reduces. We don't have the demand that we have because they've kind of. It's a conundrum. They've grown so much that they don't need as much anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's not. It's just like we move into higher value-added industries until we start to run out of them. So do they. They're going to run out of manufacturing industries, and they're going to get competition from other emerging countries. Vietnam is the greatest example. It's a smaller country, but they're doing everything China does cheaper,
right,
and with lower prices, lower wages, and all that sort of stuff. And these countries like China also has an aging problem. China is going to age faster than North America. They don't peak in their what we call their spending wave from their baby boom generation until about 2015 to 20, in that time range, a little after us. But once they peak, they don't have an echo boom of our size, and they don't have immigration from the past. And so they're going to age almost as fast as Europe and Japan. Mm. So China's got some aging problems as well as rising costs, and, of course, rising costs to support all those aging people, whereas India doesn't. India's got a very young population, as a lot of Southeast Asian and Mideastern countries do. So that's another dynamic. The demographics are very different for countries around the world. There is a lot of growth for the next decades, but these emerging countries are going to be growing. And let's say India is the epitome, because they don't peak till about 2065 to 70 by our models. But they're going to have the Western world that they've been selling to, and in part of the world economy, the richest countries, are going to be declining. We're more plateauing. Europe and Russia and East Europe are going to decline for decades to come. And so that takes a big piece out of the world economy. So from our point of view, from 1983 up until now, and particularly up until 2000 when that tech boom peaked, we've seen the greatest boom in history. All cylinders, everybody was firing. Emerging world and Europe, United States. Now, the largest part of the GDP in the world, the Western countries, start to age, including East Asia, which means China down the road, Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan. And so really, yeah, you got all these emerging countries, but they got lower per capita GDPs and standards of living. And there's a lot of countries in the world, Asia's not as much, but just even with urbanization and technologies and a lot of the trends in the last century, like Latin America, they don't get as high a standard of living as does the United States or Europe or even Singapore and places like that. Mm-hmm. So the third world, I think, will not get as rich as the first world, and it's going to be fighting the slowing of the first world. So we're going to have a mixed boom after this. And I think the whole world gets hit by this commodity crisis and this banking crisis at first, and everybody slows down.
We talked about the RTC issue today, which was a real shock, real amazing. I mean, you know, what's happening here, which I have very mixed emotions. I don't want anybody losing money. I don't want anybody getting hurt, right? Nobody does. And I am so, frankly, pissed off that it seems that either we have such a desperate situation that is going on right now that they have to continually, not only in the morning, a concerted global effort with $250 billion thereabout, yeah, that's pumped into the various countries around the world to make sure things, you know, do well, and then in the afternoon come out. By the way, there's a lot of talk these days. Have you noticed? Not a lot of action. There's liquidity pumped in. There's not real money. You know, availability, in other words. There is this Paulson standing behind Fannie Mae and Freddie and saying that we will make sure that things are okay, but not actually putting the money on the table right now. And the same thing here is, you know, we're thinking about doing an RTC kind of thing. I mean, it's very vacant of real absolute, you know, here's what we're going to do, here's the plan, this is implemented at this point. And I think my biggest concern is that we have not allowed the real players that were really the nasty boys in all of this to fail. And it's
right,
causing
right,
a tremendous amount. I mean, some of these banks, and one of my favorite, my favorite slash least favorite slash my nemesis company out there is Capital One Financial, okay? I find their balance books to be horrendous, balance sheets to be horrendous. I find that their overall process of what they've done to be terrible, yet the stock defies gravity. What's interesting about that is that this is the kind of bank, an RTC, could we together just easily say that an RTC type of solution is basically like a washing machine, that the banks go in dirty and they come out clean?
Well, it kind of, but here's our problem with it. If this was a short-term problem, oh, yeah, you know, housing got a little overbuilt. Yeah, the banks got too loose with their financing and credit standards. It's not a short-term problem. This is a generational peak in house buying. There is not a bigger wave of people to go buy the next round of houses. House prices are not going to rebound after this. They're going to continue to go down for years, like they did in Japan when they had their generational peak back in 1991. I mean, housing prices in Tokyo are down 60-70%. We think they're going to go down 40-50% in this country. We didn't have quite as big a bubble as them, but we have a bigger demographic drop off. This is a long term problem. And what if this was short term and the government could do all this stuff and kind of hope we pull out of it and they don't get hit too hard and taxpayers will get too hard? But they're setting horrible precedents here, taking over this stuff, helping firms not to fail, even though they're trying to penalize shareholders as much as possible. They're setting a precedent where they're going to have to take this whole thing on, and it's going to be worse than they can imagine. House prices went down 30% in the Great Depression because there wasn't a big bubble. It was just a horrible downturn with high unemployment. This, we're coming into this downturn with the greatest housing bubble the world and the United States have seen in modern history. So this is going to get ugly. House prices have to go down 40-50%, and they may go down a little more than that, just to get back to fair value for the next generation of young people to buy houses. So that, think of the banking systems under this much strain when housing prices are down maybe 10% on average and 20-30% in some areas. What's it going to do when the average house is down 30-40-50% and the worst areas are down 60-70-80%? It's going to be a mess.
Yeah, but I don't understand why it is. First of all, by the way, let me just do a little quick
commercial. Yeah, I wouldn't be letting these companies fail, because they're going to fail anyway. So
right.
Why take on a tab when they're going to fail? Try to protect the mortgage holders.
Yeah, try to protect the rest of us, because at the end of the day, if they really do implement an RTC type of solution of some sort, first of all, besides the fact it's going to create a bigger issue, I agree, also because it's going to basically send a signal up that says, hey, guys, do whichever you want. We don't care what you do. We're going to rescue you in the end. And in the end, who's paying for it? It's the taxpayers. And I'm having a real big problem with all this. By the way, we're with Harry Dent, who is an amazing economist, a futurist, and author of several unbelievable books that I recommend very, very highly. You can pick it up on audible.com or at Amazon. And he is the author of the upcoming book with the really, I think it's an uplifting title, Harry, The Great Crash Ahead.
It's the Great Depression of 2010 to 2012 is our next book. It should be out by January 1st.
Very nice. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling love there. Let's just stick to this point here. And let's look. I know you look, you know, you're very far into the future, but let's just focus on right now. Let's focus on the next 12 months, if possible, or so. I mean, is all of this a lot of blowhard discussion just to save the collective asses of the people that are currently at the helms? You know, kind of, all right, let Lehman go. We'll keep Morgan Stanley. We'll keep Goldman. Goldman, we can't let gold because Paulson, you know, Paulson's a Goldie. All, you know, Kramer's a Goldie. You know, is that kind of the attitude right now? Or is it a bigger issue that, you know what, postpone the inevitable as long as possible? What the heck? I mean, why deal with it now if we could deal with it later?
Well, again, the government and people in the industry see it as a short-term thing. We see it as a longer-term thing. This is just the first phase, what we would call the appetizer. And again, we're seeing serious consolidation, you know, firms, stronger firms buying out weaker. And that's the whole point of a deflationary downturn or a depression, is to take a bubble and then break it back down to the firms that really can survive long-term and shift all the market share and assets to them because they've proven they're worthy. So this is starting to happen. I think we probably discounted the worst of this. We might go back one more time and see the Dow at 10,000. But I think what we call the A wave and Elliott wave terms, the first major downturn has come. The top was put back in October in most markets, October 2007. And we're going to see what we call a B wave, a bounce that says, okay, the government's done this. This has happened. You know, Lehman got bought. You know, Morgan Stanley merged with Wachovia. You know, all this stuff happened. AIG got a bridge loan. It looks like they can kind of make out of this in the next year or two. And, you know, the economy probably turn around and housing bottom out in the next 3 to 6 months. So I think stocks will start a choppy rally sideways to up. And that could last 3, 6, 7, 8 months even. And then sometime mid to late next year, it's actually the recovery that will kill us, because inflation has remained very buoyant. And very in line with what our indicators are saying it should be, 4 to 5%, even in this slowdown. Bonds are assuming a slowdown, so they're sitting at 4% yields, give or take. But if inflation really is 5% out in the future, and I think it really is in late 2009, bonds ought to be at 7%. And that's going to wreck the real estate market. That's going to hurt stock valuations. And on top of that, you're going to see commodity prices come running right back up to $200 plus a barrel. We think it's going to go probably to about 215, 220, maybe higher. So that's the next phase, that inflation, commodities, wreck the housing recovery, whatever slight one there is, because there isn't going to be a giant one, and hit stocks, and then and hurt economies again, including international this time. I mean, $147 oil prices hurt everybody some. I think 200 plus will finally hurt economies, especially the emerging world, enough to really cause a slowing. And then we go into the deeper downturn, or what we call the C wave down.
I can't imagine. This is going to be painful. I can feel it coming.
It's going to be painful. It's going to be worse than anybody's thinking now. And they're projecting some pretty bad stuff now. And our minimum target is that the stock markets go back to the 2002 and 98 lows, around 7,200 on the Dow and 1,100 on the NASDAQ. And the truth is they're probably going to go down a little lower than that, maybe back to the 1994 to 95 area where this bubble started. And it's the same thing we say for housing, because real estate is so different, because people are now concerned about their house or the business real estate. And we say, look, we think at a minimum house prices are going to go back to the level they were at 2000 when this bubble really took off, or at worst back to 1996 where they last kind of bottomed in the last slowdown. So you look at that, you know, in Dallas, Texas, that might be 20-30% down, and in southern Florida it might be 60-70% down, and everything in between. And the same with stocks, like the Dow's probably going to go to somewhere between about 4,000 and 7,000. And
I don't understand.
Much more pain to come.
Harry, I don't understand why, and just briefly, you know, it seems that what's gone on recently, there's some pretty bad things that went on in the, well, beyond your forecast, by the way, because you're not really not forecasting manipulation, and you're not forecasting bad behavior. You're
right.
Forecasting just realities of, you know, money in, money out kind of thing. Who's alive? Where can money come from? Consumers and things like that, right?
So, right. Without the subprime crisis, we'd be forecasting a downturn from late 2009 or 10 onwards.
Right.
So demographic slowdown.
So all of this is really just a blip in the bigger picture here, the bigger a conclusion, which you, by the way, back in, I don't remember what year, what year did you write the original Great Boom Ahead?
The Great Boom Ahead was in 1992.
I can't even read that book anymore because everything is so dog-eared. Every single page is dog-eared with big circles around things, with arrows and all that. But so you wrote that back then, and at that point you were predicting 2009 still.
Around the end of this decade, this boom would come to an end because baby boomers would just run out of earning, spending, in borrowing steam, just like the Japanese did in the late 80s.
So I asked you this before, and I talked to let me just start with this, and I want to, you know, the other day I was talking, just I think yesterday, John Dvorak, who I think you were on a show with him one time, and I talked to a cousin of mine, cousin Judy, and we talked, and I said, you know, I kind of feel like it's almost like we could just go out and do anything we want right now, and nobody's going to prosecute if you do anything wrong. Obviously, you know, wouldn't follow through on something like that, you know, but it almost seems like, you know, nobody really cares anymore how bad you know, look at from politicians, by the way, lying, outright lying, to the financial system, to, I mean, it's almost like there's just nobody cares about the, and there's no accountability, there's no ramifications. And
nobody's facing the reality of Social Security or health care and Medicaid and stuff. Well, these programs, even in a good economy, would be very questionable. And with what we're forecasting, they're not going to even be remotely sustainable. And, you know, the people are just acting like, well, it'll work out somewhere down the road. And, you know, yeah, it's true. People aren't facing reality. And that's the blessing of this, what we call this next season, our economies, like 1930 to 42. And same thing Japan just went through in the 90s. You know, everything gets brought down to reality. when everything fails. And then heroes emerge, and then people take real action, and then people do the obvious. It's just like when the house is on fire. Ordinary people become heroes and run in and save the damn baby, and they don't think about it, whether it's right or wrong, or whether they're going to get burnt or not. But it takes a crisis to get people to face stuff.
So is that Paulson?
Obama's talking about change, and everybody's talking about change. None of this change is going to happen until these systems fail. And then, I mean, FDR in 1933, when he first got in office, in 100 days, he basically passed most of the New Deal. In 100 days, he just got Congress and said, we're going to sit here for 100 days, and we're going to hammer this thing out. And it was done because we were in a crisis, 25% unemployment, stocks down 90%, banks failing all over the place. People, action came quickly. And we're doing some of the right, I think people learned from that crisis, and we had restrictions on trade and tariffs just before that made the Depression worse, and the government felt the opposite of now. Instead of bailing everybody out, they wanted to give tougher medicine. And now I think they're going the other way. They're bailing out too much. I really think, I agree with you that we ought to say, how can we facilitate the restructuring of mortgages as good as possible? But let's not bail out. If firms did the wrong things and overcommitted, let them go under. So they're going to go under or have to merge anyway.
Well, especially the credit card companies. That's the one that really just blows my mind. That's what blows my mind. I mean, I understand. I totally get the mortgage.
And then they'll be next. And commercial real estate's rolling over, and credit card companies will be the next mess.
Yeah,
and
unless the RTC comes in. You get a Capital One, and I keep on harping on this, but you get a Capital One, who's a credit card company, but a bank, obviously. That's how they get the thing going, right? They get the deposits in, and then they put it over there.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to me. Let me ask you, so as an investor, and that's what you do. You forecast things, and now I can thread the needle. Let's say that here we are, and let's say that things will get better from here only because this was a situation made by subprime. They're going to fix that. We're not in the Harry Dent world yet of the massive problems brought about by the age change and all that. We're right now in this bizarre, kind of precursor, as you call it, the appetizer, okay, and with this main course, this horror of a main course coming up. We are what? So let's just say, latter part of 2008, do I go and say I have the green light from the government? I have no real significant problems, unless we can't see these right now, but assuming for a moment there's nothing else that's going on. Do I say, I can commit money to the markets, just be very, very careful, and then say I'll pull out if I have to? Or do I say, I'm not really going to commit because there's a lot more happening, and who knows the exact date this thing can tumble? And it could. Listen, Harry, let's be honest, right? With all your theory here, there is still the possibility. There's still the possibility that things can continue, go up here, but just really very quickly go sour. If in fact,
there is. I mean, we basically telling our newsletter subscribers recently that, if we do not see, with this turnaround here, if we do not see, and it could have happened today, if we do not see a 90% upside day and maybe more than one, then there's no confirmation that we've reached a bottom for now, and this thing could roll over and we could be down at Dow 9,800 or 10,000 in the next week or two or three. So, we are probably getting out of the woods on this. I'd say it's more likely we bottomed here. But we could go lower first, and there's still some downside risk. Now, if we get down there, if we get down to 10,000 on the Dow and 2,000 on the NASDAQ, and that range or a little lower, I'd say, that's a pretty safe place to be buying for a bounce.
But Harry, we just artificially fixed the problem. We went in. Now what happened is we rigged
it. But that can last a while.
That's what I'm saying.
What we do is we monitor leading indicators, and not the ones the government looks at, but some better ones from ECRI. And they pretty much say, look, they've been saying this is going to be a mild recession, kind of like 1990, and we ought to come in. We got to wait till see if they really do turn up. But, we'll probably come out of this early, by the second quarter next year. So if the market starts sensing a recovery, housing prices are going down at less and less rates. Now, most of the downturn seems to have happened there. If housing prices flatten out or even come up a little bit, people are going to say, well, okay, we're over the worst of this. And that would allow a rally for several months until we start to see, oh, my gosh, no, this oil bubble's not over, and, oh, my gosh, inflation is going to come back, as people feared. And, and then just as all that's time that quits, then baby boomers really will be ready to slow down in spending. I mean, people just do this. I mean, That's been our premise for 20 years. Around 2009, give or take a year, 2008, 9, 10, the baby boomers would finally just slow down, just like the Japanese did. The Japanese consumers just slowed down, you know, in 1999.
Yeah. I'm not a baby boomer.
Well, yeah, I mean, because, you know, when your kids, when you get your kids out of school,
right,
you don't need a bigger house. If you know, your cars, you drive half as much of that because you're not carting them around to soccer. So, yeah, people start spending less, and you're getting closer to retirement, so you start saving more.
Right.
So that slows down the economy.
So
there's no two ways around it.
Let's, again, this book, The Great Crash Ahead, coming in December, and I mean the book, not the crash itself. Although, who knows? It may come at the same time. Wouldn't that be great for book sales? But terrible for everybody, but great for book sales. You may have to change. What's the actual title? That's the title I have. What's your actual title?
It's The Great Depression of 2010 to 2012 is the title of the book. We've changed that from our galleys. And, you know, we really see the next serious crash starting in mid to late 2009, somewhere in that time frame. Now, it might start earlier. It could start earlier of anything, but I think the markets are going to be more in a sideways trading range. Let's call it 10,000 to 13,200 on the Dow for the next year. And then at some point, they're going to break down out of that, and then you're going to get to, you know, a serious crash, a crash that's going to end up being more serious than this one.
So let's finish up on this. Let's finish up with probably what the, I guess, the tip of the Harry Dent theory iceberg is going to be, because this is going to be a big part of this. If any of your stuff is right, it's going to be a big part. And let's talk about the political environment that we're going to be in moving forward. Who's going to be president?
You know, normally we can tell, you know, a year or two ahead based on where we think the economy is going to be. But here you've got, even though the economy's on the bad side and a war that's unpopular, you know, somehow you got a neck and neck race. I don't know who's going to win. You know, I'd still have to give the small edge to Obama at this point, because normally Republicans wouldn't even have a chance in this type of environment. But if McCain does win, he will not be reelected in 2012. We would make that very definitive forecast right out of the gate.
Yeah, well,
but he's going to get blamed for this downturn of the Republicans. If Obama wins, it'll be kind of like Bush coming in 2001. He's coming into a tech wreck that's already happening. And so even though it gets worse, he doesn't get blamed for it. So Obama may get some blame, and in fact, he'll particularly get blamed if he runs out and raises taxes right away. That'll be a way that the Republicans say, see, he made this happen, even though that wouldn't be fully the case, or even mostly the case. But I think from 2012, you are one way or the other, you're going to get a strong mandate for change and a strong Democratic president who's going to come in. I mean, we've had Republicans. We have this 80-year cycle where the first 40 is more innovation and growth and pro-business and the rich getting richer. And then the second half, the last 40 years, like from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, it's spreading and trickling down to the middle class, and it's more Democratic-oriented. It's more spreading the wealth. So I think we're in for an era for, you know, more Democratic dominance in the White House and in the Congress for, you know, next 30, 40 years.
Harry Dent, I really like you. I don't really like what you have to say.
And yeah, I think most people don't these days. They loved us in the 90s.
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
it's probably you get a lot of people. You get a lot of hate mail.
No.
All right, well,
most of the people, I mean, we don't go out there and promote us. Our newsletter is not just the people who've read our books and come to our seminars. We don't go out and push ourselves on the world. So most of the people who listen to us, you know, have a lot of respect for our work.
Right.
And they know we've been saying downturn for 20 years. So it's not a surprise to them. It's not like we're getting bearish just because we think the government's screwing up a few things or the bank screwed up some stuff.
Right.
It's a bigger trend change here. We would have this downturn anyway, and we would have a real estate crash anyway.
Right. It's not like don't shoot the messenger, obviously. But so if somebody wants to get, so tell me about the newsletters you have real quick.
It's a monthly newsletter, and we also, I mean, like the last few days, I put out about 6 updates in 2 days. You know, we give updates when things change, but, you know, it's monthly, and then quarterly we have an expanded issue where we really update people on our research and longer-term demographic trends, or like you say, migration trends in the United States, and what states people are moving to. I mean, we look at a lot of issues for businesses and investors, and it's It's really the most important thing we have. Our major books come out every 5 or 6 years, but in between, a lot of stuff happens. Our research advances, and most people really never hear about it. So that I mostly encourage people, get on our newsletter. It's not that expensive, and you can get a free sample at our website at hsdent.com. And it's the best thing we have to offer.
Well, we'll make sure to put a link on there. Harry Dent, thanks so much for bringing us this news, albeit not not happy news, but news anyway. I think it's really important for everybody to kind of really understand what's happening. I know, as I'm sure you say as well, you hope you're wrong. I mean, right? You hope you're wrong. But unfortunately, all the things are pointing towards you being very right here, and you've been very right so far. So thanks a lot for coming on board and spending some time with us.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
And now let's get right down to a discussion. Let's get to him on the phone. Fausto Puglisi from Cyber Trading University. Let's talk some day trading.
All right, we are tired of the markets going up and down, the volatility, all things that are just making us all really crazy. And I will tell you that, you know, it is time to, I think, debunk the whole idea of just buying and holding, buying an index fund, just holding on the sideline. About 10, 15 years ago, 12 years ago maybe, you know, asset allocation was really king. It was all about diversification, asset allocation. And, you know, you can't hold on to that forever, because when you have markets as we've seen these days, it's important to recognize that, you know, you really need to do something different, because buying and holding only allows you to make money in one direction, right? You only make money if the markets go up. But what happens when the markets go down? And we've seen plenty of that in the recent days. So what I thought we'd do is, you know, and he's very, very popular when I bring him on. His name is Fausto Puglisi. He is the director, the founder of Cyber Trading University. He taught me a great deal about day trading. I went through about 5 of his courses. This is, I guess, a free pitch for Fausto. But, you know, really one of the great traders, because it teaches you how not only to trade, but how not to lose your shirt, which can be done. So many people, I guess. Hey, Fausto, how are you, Fausto?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me again.
So listen, seriously, how many people do you think that, maybe not specifically to your course, but how many people start and desire to do day trading, but just kind of when they really start doing it, they just wash out?
Really want me to answer that?
No.
About
all right, we'll do it. I'll turn the recorder off. You tell me now. Go ahead, tell me.
About 80%.
Really?
80%.
Why is that?
Why? Because a lot of people want to go out there. They want to try it out. They think it's pretty simple. They want to benefit from this volatility, and you can see what's going on at the stock market. They don't. The American dream is not to go short. Everybody goes long. They don't know how to trade, and with these unbelievable volatile markets, it's just, they get themselves in trouble. And and it's one of the biggest failure rates is someone just not getting educated. They figure it's easy enough just to go back and just do it themselves, but it's not as simple as it is. It's easy. It's simple to trade, but it's not easy. The hard part is the discipline.
Well, you know, I guess I don't think I told you this story, but I had this terrible desire. I don't know what came over me, but I had this desire to go to one of these courses. There was a course that was called, I think, what was it called, Strategic Stocks, or I don't know, some stock, Success, Stock Success or something like that. And it was given by a pretty well-known guy. As a matter of fact, it was given by the Rich Dad, Poor Dad folks. And I went there, I was so curious, and it was relatively close to where I work and live. And it was, even though it was in the middle of the day, I figured, I'll go over there and check it out. So I sat down and I started listening. And for my listeners, I think I mentioned this story once before, but basically, they started talking about how, you know, you've been living under the man who's been making money off your back for so many years, and you got to be crazy to be getting, you know, kind of the money you do at your job, and you're going to have to, you know, reach out and make money for yourself, and this whole, like, revival, you know? And they started talking about, it was unbelievable, and I found myself kind of getting into it. I'm like, yeah! Yeah!
Some preacher.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, and the guy was really skilled, and he started talking about how for a half hour a day, I mean, anybody for a half hour a day can make money, and they can make all the money they need in a half hour a day by trading stocks. And do you think you could do it? Look at these guys. Buffett can do it. This guy can do it. Peter Lynch. And I was amazed at this quick fix, you know, kind of mentality, and horrified at the potential for money that could be lost. And I think that a lot of people think that, don't I? Mean, is that what happens? I mean, they get sucked in by this?
Well, it's not that they get sucked in. I mean, I totally agree with him. You know, a lot of people get the impression that you have to trade all day in the market, and that's not true. The best time to trade in the market is where people think is the worst time to trade, the first hour and the last hour, because that's where the most volatility happens. And but what happens is a lot of people don't know how to control and don't know when to take losses and when to take profits, and they don't have the proper tools. They try to do this as the cheapest way as possible. You know, they want everything for free, and they don't realize that, you know, to be a profitable trade, just like we were just talking about earlier about execution systems, people don't realize that the only thing that's free is the cheese in a mousetrap. You know,
yep.
That's it.
Yeah.
You know, you got to spend a little money. You have to get the right tools, the right bells and whistles. And what he just told you, he's right. But also, you got to be very compliant, be very careful that it's not as simple as it seems sometimes. And you said,
well, the thing that worries me, and listen, I'm not ragging on anybody, because I think that we all get the taste of the glory. I mean, I'm there too, right? I mean, we all get the taste of, wow, we want to grab that brass ring. And but my concern more is, it's not so much that people fall for it. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about the individual, me or anybody listening, falling for it. I'm talking about being sucked into something. I mean, totally different, right? The other side of the equation. Looking at it and being told all these things, and these things that aren't necessarily true, and being shown the kind of pot of gold. And then, you know, kind of not telling the other side of the story that you really could lose.
You know what, Andrew? I totally agree with you. And you're right. Suckering people in, and, you know, in a way of trying to, you know, explain it in a way that this is as simple as it is. You know, one thing when I teach my courses, Andrew, one thing I try to do, and the only reason why I know this because I was a broker and I know how to be very, very compliant, I definitely put more fear into people's eyes and let them know that, do you really want to do this? Is this what you really want to do? Because if you really want to do it, this is how you have to do it. You could lose a lot of money. You think a marriage is great? Think how much expensive a divorce is going to be. Stocks are the king of costing you a lot of money and losses. So one thing that, you know, like here's somebody like you telling me that is trying to make it sound and glory and great, and it, you know, it is. I mean, listen, I totally agree that being a trader is one of the best jobs of the world. You are your own boss. You can come and go whenever you please. You could do whatever you want. But it's not as simple as it looks. You know, you got to make sure that someone's going to. You got to tell the person, well, you know, this, you're going to need certain tools. You're going to have to get a proper direct access broker. You're going to have to, most importantly, which is why you have me here, you got to get educated. You know, you just can't go out there and think you're going to accomplish this by just open up an E-Trade account. I mean, it's not as simple as it seems. But you don't want to go out there and try to make it, you know, it's just money's being printed and here's cash and you're going to make money just trading stocks. It's not as easy.
So let's talk about some of the rules. So if someone out there that hasn't heard you before, and you know, you teach this course, CyberTrader University, and you teach these courses, and let's kind of do a mini course right here, right? So what is kind of like the first thing you need to know and do if you're thinking about, I mean, let's talk about preparation, I guess. So somebody wants to trade. And when I say trade, let's kind of identify this, right? Let's really define this. When we talk about trading, we're not kind of talking about swing trading. We're not talking about investing and kind of managing a portfolio like, you know, I do for my clients. We're not talking about that kind of thing. We're talking about, you know, kind of absolute in and out scalping, day trading, you know, looking for the edge on a daily basis. I know you have one rule. I've seen it before, and this is Fausto. Yeah. He puts up the screen and it says, "You will not hold overnight." Repeat after me. You will not hold overnight. And we have to, you know, kind of everybody has to, you know, we have to all abide by that before we enter, right?
Exactly. And I actually make people print it and cut it and put it on the computer monitor to make sure they don't do it, because it's right. One of the biggest.
Wait. You made me staple it to my forehead.
Everywhere. Anywhere that's going to make him do the not do, I make him put it where it's supposed to be. So they don't do it.
Yeah. So what do? You get up in the morning and you're going to trade. So it's 9:30 in the morning. What do you do in your pre-routine workout, let's say, or whatever you do to get going?
Well, the first thing I would always tell anybody when I first come out and teach everyone, something that's not the most exciting part of it is obviously, you know, the mechanics about using the execution system, how to read level two quotes, you know, basically how to use the ECNs, use Island, use Arca. You know, that is... You know, hands down, you know, not to get around your question, but that's one of the most important. That's probably 50% of the failure rate of the business, right there alone. Not knowing the spread.
The thing you're mentioning is you can't trade and use a regular HTML-based product, right? So you can't go and look at, like, I'm just picking a, you know, something. You can't use like a Yahoo, for example,
and go into your Schwab or your Fidelity account and expect that Yahoo is going to give you the kind of quote information that you need, even if it's very detailed, to then effectively trade utilizing a day trading process. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And, you know, it's funny. I just did a course today, and I had a student call me up and said, Fausto, he goes, whatever you told me, he actually bought my course. He's like, I did exactly what you told me. I had my online broker. I did a trade. They did exactly what you said that they were going to do. They procrastinated. They delayed my quote. They said everything that you were going to say. There's delayed quotes. I hit cancel. I didn't see my order got posted out there on level two. You know, they did everything I can. And right there and then I knew that I had to go to the next level. That's when I knew that, you know, enough's enough and I was getting taken advantage of. And now I need to have something that's going to put me in the driver's seat. You know, I'm tired of taking public transportation. It's time to drive your own car. And that's, you know, that's probably the one step that everyone has to go to before they can start really being a successful trader.
Well, because the traders that are on the other side, let's say that you go, again, it doesn't matter whether it's E-Trade or Schwab, it doesn't matter where it is. But if you put a transaction in, it's essentially going to, it doesn't necessarily going to be executed right then and there by these the platforms that are HTML-based, if you will, web-based. It's usually going to go to a trading desk and then execute.
Yeah, it's called payment for order flow. Your listeners should all go in the back of their account statements and look at it. 80% of the profits that the online broker makes is something called payment for order flow. What that means, they're taking your order and they're selling it to another brokerage firm and they're paying them for your order. So your online broker is just a middleman. And, you know, and that's not what you want.
Wait. So hold it. Back up. All right. So wait a minute. Let's go through this thing. I don't say this, you know, rhetorically. So now I put a trade in for 100 shares of XYZ stock, right? And it goes into my broker, and you're telling me they can direct it so it can be traded somewhere else, right? That's what you just
said to me. That's exactly right. It's called payment for.
So I may be, so I'm paying $8.95 commission for something, right? Whatever it is, let's say, right? So you're telling me that there's more in cost embedded?
Let me tell you something. If your online broker depend on $8.95, they'll be filing bankruptcy at the end of the business day. They're making several hundred dollars on your order. What they do basically is, they'll take your order and they'll sell it. They'll try to sell it. If they can't sell it to somebody else for payment for order flow, then they're going to go out there and they'll work the order themselves, their own traders, which is more work for them. First thing they're going to do is they're going to check their own inventory. If they have stock and inventory, they'll sell you what they have. If not, then they're going to go out to the street. They'll use a direct access execution system, which I show my students all in class. Actually, that's one of the biggest things that sells all the students. Once they see a direct access execution system go out there, they're sold on that.
Well, it's all those great colors, man. I mean, if you can't get them with the facts, the colors always do it.
Well, it's just to see happening right back. Okay. You see Goldman Sachs, and all of a sudden watch, I'm going to go out there and outbid Goldman Sachs in Yahoo. Boom, it's within a fraction of a second. I'm like, could you do that with your online broker? They're like, no, of course not. Because what they're doing is they're going to place it. Like, for example, you put a limit order out there to buy a stock for $25. They're going to go out there, and they're going to try to buy it at, I don't know, $24.80 or $24.50. And if they get it, then they'll sell it to you for $25, and they'll make the difference. On 1,000 shares, they'll make 50 cents. 50 cents, you know, even 20 cents on 1,000 shares is $200. So you could. I'll be happy to pay you $8 a ticket. You know?
Right. So if Goldman knows that there's these direct access, so if I'm going head to head with Goldman, right, or whoever it is out there, again, it doesn't, the names can be, you know, changed around and moved around. But if I'm going head to head with Goldman, and Goldman has they know that there's direct access in, you know, people out there trading, right? They can show whatever they want. I mean, how are you so sure that if Goldman says they're buying, let's say, 10,000 shares of this stock, that they're really, really showing it? I mean, they can hide their trades. They could do things on a very sophisticated platform where it only leaks in a little at a time and hides things, and then rotates it to different, hides it between, let's say, Arca or any of the other ECNs. The electronic platforms. They can hide their trades and not come out. So, I mean, is some of the things that kind of were in the beginning of your process a little bit different now?
Well, not as much. I mean, listen, about Goldman, just to let you know, 70% of their profits are made through their trading department. I don't know if you know that. So, specifically in just trading the market. And about hiding orders, they hide orders, but one of the, you know, Andrew, one of the most famous things I teach, I do a lot of guest speakings at the trade shows. I do something called market maker traps. It's one of my signature classes that I do, and I'll show you how market makers use something called refreshing, how they're, like you just said, how do you know they're really a seller but they're not a buyer? You know, trading, you know this, I know this, and your listeners are probably going to learn this the hard way until they get into the game. Trading is a game. You just got to know how to play the game, and you just got to understand that if a market maker knows a stock is going to go down, they're going to make you think it's going to go up, and they'll go out there and they'll put fictitious bids and offers out there, and they'll hide orders through ECNs. They'll say they want to buy 100 shares on a level 2, and they'll sell you 10,000 on the ECN book. You know, for your listeners, it must probably be like, what the hell is Fausto talking about? Well, that's why, you know, like I taught you from the day one when we met. I don't know how long has it been. Almost 10 years now, I think.
But I know it's been a while.
It's been a long time.
It's been a while, old man.
Nothing really has changed. You know, being one of the original day traders who started this when I was like 500 of them. Now there's almost 20 million. You know, nothing really has changed other than from fractions to decimals. The game is still the same. You know, you just got to know how to play the game and just be very. Be very conservative to just make your days pay. You know, you'd be surprised, Andrew, that people don't even realize that if they bought 1,000 shares of stock and if the stock moved up 20 cents, just 20 mm-hmm. cents, they make $200 mm-hmm. a day. $200 right. a day is almost $50,000 a year. You know, some people wish they could make $50,000 a year. And so some people are too greedy to take the 20 cents. They're like, what the hell is 20 cents? That's nothing. You do your math, you do it consistently, you can make a lot of money in the stock market, but you got to know how to be disciplined, you need to know how to play the game, and just be patient to pick those spots and see how the market makers play those games.
Right. Yeah. So so just to back up for a second, because I was thinking, as you were saying this, I was thinking of something when you talk about the traps, because if you don't visualize this, and everybody listening out there, you probably don't understand what the heck it really looks like, but I was thinking about something. Just tell me if this makes sense. I never really thought of it this way before. But, you know, and maybe it's not the greatest thing to think about, but when that tsunami hit Phuket, Thailand,
uh-huh.
Way back when, and you remember there was that commentary that talked about how there was these people that were kind of amazed about the water was rushing out, and they never saw such a thing, and they all went out on the beach to see what was going on because all the water was rushing out. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the water rushed in and all these people unfortunately drowned and all. But think about that. That's kind of like the trap, I think, where, you know, what they do is they kind of, you know, make it look like one thing is happening. They may bring down the stock and then only to, you know, when you're least expecting it and you're kind of bought into it, all of a sudden they're going the other direction on you and kind of just, you know, drowning you with what's happening, whether it's on the short side or on the long side. Does that make sense?
Exactly. It makes perfect sense. I mean, think about it. You have stock, Andrew, in your portfolio. You're a market maker. You're one of the top market makers in the stock. You trade about 20-30% of the volume of the stock. You know the stock's going down. Or maybe you have one of your hedge fund guys that says, listen, I want you to dump 300,000 shares of the stock by the end of the day, okay? Now, if you went out there and advertised that you want to sell 300,000 shares on the offer, do you think the other market maker is going to sit on the bid and buy it?
Yep, no.
Of course not. No. Of course not. So what they do is they can't scare the market because they'll tank the market. So they'll go out there and they'll constantly keep doing whatever they can to make people buy it from them, and they'll just piece it out little by little, and they'll just pretend they want to buy it, which will help them sell them shares in the offer. Once they got enough people, then they'll hit the bid little by little and piece out. That's what we call trading. And, you know, and that's one of the catastrophes that one of the problems that we have in the market that becomes so volatile. And but it's you know, a catastrophe for everyone else that's listening is an opportunity for a trader like myself and like yourself. It's like shorting. You know, in the past past month, we've been going up and down, what, 700, 800 points? People are sitting there.
Well, everybody thinks that's the biggest. I think the biggest shanda, as we say in my house, the biggest problem is that people
have been told all these years, and again, it's not you and me that are when I say you and me, the average, I'm talking about us, like being the average guy, the average investor, or anybody that's listening to me. It's not that we have these beliefs. These beliefs have been put upon us that buy and hold is the only way to go, because you want to make sure that you don't miss the best 5 days of the market. You want to make sure that you don't, you know, you diversify, all these different things. And what has really hit me squarely in the head over the last couple of, maybe even 3 years now, is that, you know, more than ever, trading is another diversification process. Not only do you want to have some, maybe not right now, but international and fixed income and small cap, large cap, all these various things that you want to do from an asset allocation standpoint, potentially. But what I think is really key is that when you look at trading, it's a part of the process that when it doesn't correlate with anything else in your portfolio, potentially, and it can give you the opportunity to have you better diversified, because it's now not only the time in and not the type of asset that you have, but it kind of brings in another whole style, if you will, of trading. And I think it's a very smart thing to do, not recklessly. It doesn't have to be done compulsively. But I want to make this productive. I want to talk to you about it. If somebody's listening and they want to consider doing this, and day trading is not for everybody. But if you are listening to me, and the word day trading, trading, shorting, active, if it bothers
Stop
you, if it makes the kind of the hair, yeah, if it makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up, and you just can't deal with this because that's not the way things are supposed to go, I want you to clear your head. I want you to forget about that. The markets are down, I don't know, 14, 15% year to date. That's not the way to go either, right? So let's just kind of think about, maybe there's something, whether you do it or there's, you know, maybe there's a, it could be a hedge fund manager or somebody that does this for you, or you just do it, you know, sometimes, and you, you know, whatever it is. What is it? Give me some basic rules and some basic kind of, take me through the morning and what you're going to do and what you're looking for to find a stock, and some of the rules that you have, Fausto.
Well, the first thing I always, what I would do is I check, first I watch CNBC. I mean, you basically have a platform that's going to give you a top 20 list. And the thing I look for is stocks that have action that it came out with news. What the news is, good or bad, I don't care. As long as they're in the top 20 list and I have it defaulted by percentage gainers and losers, that is going to tell me, okay, these are the stocks I want to trade because they're active for the day. And like I said, if it's on one financial station, it's on every financial station. What I'll basically do is look at all those stocks, and usually I probably have about 3 or 4 of them, because not every stock has a very good spread. It's another thing I'd be very careful of, that you can get in, if you're wrong, that you're not going to be risking a stock that has very big spread. So you try to find a stock with a tight spread, with good volume, and it's got good volatility on the day. And basically what I'll do is I'll check out who the dominating market maker is in the stock. I'll see where he's on the bid on the level two, if he's on the bid and ask. And then basically what I'll do is I'll on top of that, I'll just follow the money. Just see where the time and sales are, see if the transactions are taking place more on the bid or on the ask, see if the market maker is buying it or he's selling it. And as I'm watching it, boom, I'm just looking to make my little day's pay. I'm not looking to maximize it. I'm not trying to be a pig. I'm just trying to grab the crumbs. That's it. And then if I see a small opportunity there, I'll just take it and then move on and close out the day.
So this is going on in the morning. This is all the things you're doing to prepare. We know it's actually, let me just, I think this is a good time to mention this. This is really cool. You do introduction courses. Okay. And by the way, gang, you know, I'm pitching this because I really do believe in this, and you don't hear me pitching too much. I mean, every once in a while I'll pitch my book on Audible, or tell you to go out and, by the way, go buy The Disciplined Investor at Amazon, you know, whatever it is. I mean, you know, for those of you hearing me the first time, that's my book and tells you how to do a lot of things what we're talking about. But, to be successful in this business, and when I say business, I mean in the game of investing, you have to do a lot of different things and understand all the gamuts, right? So even if you're not going to be a day trader, I think it makes sense to understand all the things that go into this, because you may be actually buying a stock against a day trader or against a market maker one day. So you have to know when a good time is to actually buy the stock. That's what that's about. So Fausto, because, you know, I think it's important to understand what you're getting yourself into. He puts a free course out, an introduction course to day trading. You get to spend some time. What's really neat is what Fausto does is, and the first time he did this, Fausto, it freaked me out, by the way, okay? So what he does is you go in and you do like a WebEx thing, and you're watching Fausto's execution platform, and he's talking you through what everything means, and then he goes live and actually
trade something, you know, maybe buys 500 or 1,000 shares or something. And I'm thinking the first time he did this, I said, wait a minute, this guy just bought shares of this thing. How is he going to be able to concentrate and trade? And what if he loses all this money? I mean, I was just like, wait a second, what is he doing? I mean, that's just, but anyway, he's got it under control. But I tell you, that definitely was, I'm sure people have mentioned that to you before, right?
Well, you know what, believe it or not, there's very few people out there in my industry, because I'm not the only school out there, very, very few, if not any of them, will go out there and put their money where their mouth is. And I'll go out there and I'll do maybe 10, 15 trades and buy and sell stocks and just show you, like, to me it doesn't affect me. Just to go out there and place an order. My main goal when I do these free seminars for the customers, for your listeners, is that, first of all, I always like to let them know, before you invest a single penny in anything, first you got to do your research and let it know if it's for you or not. And I want to go out there and I do these seminars just like how we've done these in the past and over the years. I want to make sure that a person knows what they're getting themselves involved in. And not only that, my main goal is to put as much fear as possible in your eyes to let you know that you better make sure this is what you want to do, because there's discipline, there's responsibility that comes along with it. And I'll show you how to play the game. The funny thing I do now is I quiz everybody. I do the course that I do now, Andrew, is I do a two-day course I give away for free. And it's live with me in the webinar. And you can visit my website at cybertradinguniversity.com. You'll see a banner on the left with my face on it, register for it. You click on that. It's a two-day course. It runs about an hour and a half. And I'll do a little lecturing. I'll teach you how to find market makers, how to read charts, how to find tradable stocks. And I give everybody a quiz. And it proves to them how smart or how little they know. And then I'll go out there. We'll review the quiz the next day. And then I'll go out there and do live trades. And I'll interact with all the students that are in my webinar. I'll say, Andrew, where's the bid on Goldman? Mike, where's the short that we got right now on Google? You know, or whatever it may be. And I'll show you how to find through the top 20 list, just to know how to play the game. And it at least gives everybody a feel of how the trading market works, if this is what they want to do. Because let me tell you, Andrew, it's not for everybody, you know. And before you put a single dollar into the market, maybe you have to give it to a professional, some guy like yourself.
Yeah.
Then try to.
You know what we're gonna do? Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And I think that what's refreshing is I think that you're so involved in this. It's just. It's tough, but I think in this market, like I said, it demands. I don't mean to make this like a pitch for you, but I got to tell you, it's. I think, if nothing else, it's a lot of fun to watch what you're doing, and just from an interest standpoint. So we'll put that sign up form for people that are interested right on the site. Go to the disciplinedinvestor.com on the show notes. We'll have a link so you can get right over to Fausto and put your information in, and then get you signed up for this course that's coming up, I think, on the 16th or so. And then the next course, he has them ongoing. So we'll make sure that you get into.
Every 2 weeks, we have one going on. Every 2 weeks. But the next one is coming up on September 16th. And if you missed that one, there should be one 2 weeks later. I always do one every 2 weeks.
You know what I'll do? Maybe I'll every once in a while I come on and I spend some time guesting on in his course. Maybe what I'll do is I'll just make a little hello. So anybody that wants to kind of be there when I'm in that course, is that right, Fausto?
That's more than happy. And I'm telling everybody, and make sure you let all your listeners know who's out there, and you know this as well as I do. September, October, November are the biggest, most volatile, best times of market to trade. And if you're really looking to benefit from it, these are the best times to do it.
Well, that was a great interview with discussion with Fausto, and I'll tell you that overall, when I think about these markets right now, with the lack of shorts on the financials, and the fact that we're going to see excessive volatility, this is just one of those things you really need to have in your arsenal. You need to understand how to execute, how to do trades, whether it's day trading or just actually execution on your trades when you're buying or selling or, God forbid, shorting these days. And I think that if you want to check it out, take advantage of that free course that Fausto gives over at Cyber Trading University. And we're going to have part two of that. I think next week we'll talk about, some of the tools that you need and the setups to actually, what does it look like? What does it feel like? What do you have in front of you? And we'll bring that. I'm going to kind of do that for I think it'll be some interesting thing. We'll bring that in the beginning of next week's podcast. But that's all for now. It ran a little bit longer than we usually do, but thank you so much for listening. This is Andrew Horowitz. It's episode number 75, and we hope to see you real soon next week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.